listening to One to One with Paul Costello, a podcast from the Stanford School of Medicine.
Pediatrician Neville Golden is a lead author of new clinical guidelines aimed at helping prevent obesity and eating disorders in adolescents. Childhood obesity has been growing dramatically over the past few decades, and eating disorders are the third most common chronic condition in adolescents after obesity and asthma. The guidelines were published August 21st in the journal Pediatrics and were developed in response to growing concerns about teenagers' use of unhealthy methods to lose weight. The guidelines, which are endorsed by the American Academy of Pediatrics, synthesize expanding scientific evidence that the same techniques can simultaneously prevent both obesity and eating disorders in young people. Three recommendations focus on behaviors to avoid with teens, like encouraging diets, teasing teens about weight, and weight talk. The guidelines also encourage families to eat regular meals together and promote a healthy body image by encouraging a balanced diet and exercise for fitness, not weight loss. So stay tuned for an important discussion about helping teens develop a healthy outlook about their bodies. Neville Golden is a professor of pediatrics at the Stanford School of Medicine and chief of adolescent medicine at Lucile Packard Children's Hospital, Stanford. Neville Golden, thank you for joining me on One to One.
Pleasure.
I was looking at one of the news headlines today, and it said, "Doctors want parents to stop nagging their kids about weight." Is that an accurate description, do you think, of what the guidelines are trying to accomplish?
No, the guidelines actually were not directed towards parents. They were really directed towards pediatricians. So these were the first guidelines from a professional organization that really addressed an integrated approach to both obesity prevention and prevention of eating disorders in adolescents. So while it may have been interpreted that way, it was really guidance towards pediatricians.
And what do you want pediatricians to know? What's the central, you know, instigation of why these guidelines were put into place?
Well, the focus should be not so much on weight, but rather on some of the behaviors, and particularly in healthy eating and healthy living. So what this paper does is it reviews the scientific evidence that shows that the same behaviors predispose to both conditions. And as you know, both conditions are major health issues for our society. Obesity rates have quadrupled in the adolescent age group in the past 30 years. And eating disorders are also increasing, especially in the teenage age group.
It is interesting to think that on the one hand, we have this obesity overweight problem in this country. And on the other, we have this obsession with dieting.
Well, it's interesting, but it's easy to understand if you think about it.
Tease it out. Help me
tease
understand
it out. Well, look, there is obesity, right? Prevalence rates of obesity are really high across the board, and it really starts in childhood.
And what age does it really begin? When you start to see obesity in children, at what point is that?
Well, it begins in early childhood, but actually some of that may not be long-lived. But if you are an adolescent and you're obese, you're most likely to become an obese adult. So it's late childhood and adolescence, we see that. There's a lot of focus in the media on the healthy thin ideal. And so everyone wants to be thin because thinness is equated with success and beauty. And that's the one issue. And also on the other hand, pediatricians and health providers are really promoting wellness, right? You don't want to be overweight. You don't want to be obese. But there is something in between. So people who try and become thin or become healthy, quote unquote, by restricting their diet and who do it in unhealthy ways can get into trouble. And we're seeing more and more of that.
And the language, you know, one of the things that was interesting is that it talks about the discussion of weight and food and the issues of we're spending too much time, families are spending too much time talking about weight versus lifestyle versus keeping fit.
Right. And what we are saying over here, we shouldn't talk about weight. because this is based on scientific research that shows that weight talk is associated with high risks of becoming obese later on. So if a mom gets up in the morning and puts on her dress and says, "Oh, I look disgusting, I feel fat today," those type of messages are taken in by children in the area, by her own children, not only adolescents, but younger kids also. So we've seen young kids, 8, 9, presenting with anorexia nervosa, considering themselves to be too fat and wanting to lose further weight. Where do they get that from? They don't get that from outside messages. Often they get those messages from their environment.
So what do you know about, you know, describe that situation again. The mother gets up and she puts on a dress and she's, or the father who gets up and puts on pants and says, "I'm too fat." What is the message they're sending to a child that leads to eating disorders?
Well, the message is that weight is the important criterion. So most people who develop eating disorders, first of all, were never overweight. Understand that. But the pressures out there to lose weight and be thin are definitely universal. But someone who is overweight and is trying to lose weight, if they do that in an unhealthy way, that can lead them to trouble. So what do I mean by that? Quite commonly, we'll see someone who's told by their pediatrician, you need to lose 30 pounds or 40 pounds. So what they might do is they may cut out meals and only have one small meal a day. Or they may use diet pills or laxatives or diuretics. Or they may have read on the internet, "Hey, what about causing myself to throw up? That way you can eat it and get rid of
purge.
It. Purge, right, self-induced vomiting. And what happens over time is these individuals enter into a cycle that's irreversible. They begin to obsess about weight. They begin to think about it all the time. They sometimes will get up in the middle of the night and exercise. And also this dietary restriction physiologically can lead to episodes of binging and then needs to compensate in some way, such as purging.
And eating disorders affect young girls much more than young boys.
Yes, they do, but they also affect young boys, and they affect young boys and young girls of all different racial and ethnic groups. And we're seeing more and more in young boys, and we're seeing more and more in younger children, even in the late, in the 8, 9, 10-year-olds, not just adolescents. And as you know, they persist to adulthood, and they are associated with pretty significant psychological and medical morbidity. It's said that the mortality rate is somewhere between 10 and 12 times that of other conditions, other psychological conditions.
What do we know so far about when eating disorders really begin in the life of an adolescent?
Almost universally, eating disorders begin with dieting. And that's one of the key messages of this report. Mm-hmm. Dieting doesn't work. In fact, one study showed that those who restrict their diet are 18 times more likely to develop an eating disorder. So most people who develop an eating disorder don't wake up one day and say, "Hey, I want to develop anorexia nervosa." Mm-hmm. They don't. They usually start eating to be healthy. So it's all well-intentioned, but they pick up on the media messages and they don't integrate them. For example, in the media, we see so much about good foods, bad foods, foods with sugar, foods with fat. And so young adolescents who aren't able to integrate all that information see foods as black or white, good or bad. I can tell you myriads of stories. We see this all the time. Someone who was overweight and then ends up losing 100 pounds, but basically they can't function. They can't concentrate at school. They're weak. They can faint. They come in to see the physician, and if the physician does all the vital signs in addition to just measuring weight, one might see that their heart rate is 30 or 40, or their blood pressure is low and changes on standing. So we call that unstable vital signs, and that's one of the indications for inpatient medical hospitalization.
And when a child who is obese, overweight, comes into the clinic, what is the language, what is the conversation that you're now urging pediatricians to have?
Yeah.
How are they to frame that conversation?
Yeah, I think this is an important question and one that we don't really know the answer to yet, because there aren't a lot of studies that have asked children and adolescents what kind of language they would prefer. But there are studies that have assessed parents. And a lot of the language that we use, such as obesity, morbid obesity, is pretty derogatory. So to answer your question, if someone was overweight, I might say, look, this is your weight, and this is in the overweight range, or it's in an unhealthy range, and let's see what you want to do about that. And what type of behaviors do you want to discuss today? And I'll give you five options. Cut down on soda. Cut down on TV time. What about increasing your activity? And let's talk about one of those. So that's a way of diverting the conversation from weight itself to a behavior, and then using something like motivational interviewing to try and work on that behavior with the teen. And by the way, one other point is that this is best done not in isolation, but as a family. Mm-hmm. So that the whole family can be involved in both family meals, family activities, and not just focus on this individual's weight.
Why is it so important, as the guidelines state, for families to eat together? What happens in that dynamic?
So we don't really know what happens in the dynamic, but we can suppose what happens. But I think the point is, all these guidelines are based on research findings. So the findings do show that families who have family meals together have improved nutrient content in their diets, increased quantities of fruits, vegetables, etc., and also focus less on their body shape and weight. What might happen? One possibility is that parents have an opportunity to model healthy behaviors. That's one. The other is it's also an opportunity to speak to their kids. Because what's happening nowadays is people are so busy that they're always running around. The adolescents are busy, the parents are busy, and a whole week can go by without one family meal. Family meals don't have to happen on every day, but a couple of times a week is obviously better than none.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that sort of, when I was thinking of that, it sort of presents a prior family life. We don't have families, really, that are many times two parents sitting down, you know, at 5:30, as my family did, 5:30 every night. We sat down, you know, my parents watched the news at 5:30, we ate dinner, we had, you know, everything laid out. That's not really realistic anymore today.
But it is realistic. If you do it once a week, that's better than none. Or if you do it twice a week, it could be a Sunday evening. It could be a Friday evening. It could be a Wednesday evening. But it might be a good thing that a mom or dad comes back from work at an appropriate time and you have this family meal. And it should be a time that's an enjoyable time as well. Not a time when parents are nagging their kids about various things, but rather a time to just enjoy the meal and interact.
I found this statement really interesting that most adolescents, and you just said it a while ago, most adolescents who develop an eating disorder were not previously overweight. So these kids are being told, they're constructing in their head, something is wrong with their body, and they begin an eating disorder when they really do not have a problem with weight. What's that all about?
Right. There are lots of different issues. One is that there are some terrific studies done on young men who were healthy, conscientious objectors in the time of the Second World War, and they were voluntarily starved to see the effects of starvation on activity, on medical issues, and also on psychological functioning. So these were about 35 young men, healthy between the ages of about 18 to 25. And they were voluntarily starved for 6 months, semi-starvation. And I always ask people, how many calories do you think they were starved on? Most people will say 200 calories, 300 calories. In truth, this was a standardized diet of 1,600 calories a day. Some people are shocked to realize that that's semi-starvation, but it is. And these young men began to obsess about their weight. They began to dream about food. They began to exercise excessively, some of them. Some of them began to binge and purge. Some became depressed, and they developed all the medical findings that we see in young people with anorexia nervosa. That is the low heart rate, the low blood pressure, decreased interest in members of the opposite sex, low heart rates, resting energy expenditure was down, sperm counts were down, etc. My point being is that if I put you or I on semi-starvation, that may happen to either of us. But having said all of that, this is obviously going to affect someone who's predisposed. And there's a certain type of individual who's predisposed. Usually it's someone who's really bright, high achieving, but despite all those achievements, feels insecure about herself or himself. And so they get involved in the semi-starvation to feel better. But again, this takes a life of its own.
What are the disparities between obesity rates among minority youth?
Yeah, so obesity rates are much higher among minority youth and probably related to the cost of higher quality foods such as fruits and vegetables versus processed foods that are mass produced. That's part of it. There's no question about that. But actually in this country, African Americans and Hispanics have high rates of body dissatisfaction as well. In fact, Hispanics have higher rates than both African Americans and whites. So it's not just, and that's the racial and ethnic issue, but it's also socioeconomic. We also, though, nowadays see eating disorders in all age groups and all socioeconomic groups. So yes, obesity is more prevalent in, say, Alaskans, some minority groups as well, but you see it across the board, and the same for eating disorders.
And what are the problems that when you have an eating disorder that you carry into adulthood, which many people who have eating disorders do carry it into adulthood, what health problems are they really facing and dealing with?
Well, firstly, I'm a pediatrician and I work with adolescents, and we say that actually eating disorders are preventable. Mm-hmm. And actually, there is cure. So it's not necessarily a disease like chronic alcoholism. And the research, again, has shown that the earlier the intervention and the shorter the duration of symptoms, the better the outcome. We have good research to show that. So if we can intervene early, it still lasts months to maybe a year or two, but it doesn't have to go on to adulthood. But if it does, the medical morbidities and the psychological morbidities are tremendous. I already said that death rates are increased 10 to 12 fold. Chronic conditions include osteoporosis, increased fragility, fractures of the bones, deformities, decreased cardiac function, decreased respiratory function, and then also all the other cognitive issues, social isolation, depression. They don't live a happy life. It's a good thing to intervene early,
right,
and prevent chronicity.
And treat it.
And treat it.
And what are some of the most successful treatments today? What are you uncovering about treatments that are most effective?
So what we've learned over the last maybe 10, 20 years is that family-based treatment for children and adolescents is probably one of the most effective forms of treatment. And this is very different from the situation of 20 years ago. 20 years ago, people blamed the parents. Today, we recognize that parents are actually part of the solution. So family-based treatment is a treatment modality where the parents take control of the refeeding process. And some of the best research was done here at Stanford on family-based treatment in children and adolescents. So that's a psychological treatment, and as part of that, there's also a team approach whereby you need medical monitoring and also the intervention of a dietitian. So it's a team approach.
But when you say put the family in charge, what does that mean?
What that means is that a dad is a CEO of a big company and he has a 14-year-old daughter with anorexia nervosa. Okay, parents, mom and dad, have to refeed their child. That is, they prepare the meals, supervise the meals, and make sure that that kid eats all the meals. Dad may have to take a leave of absence from his CEO position, or he may have to come home early to have dinner with his daughter and the rest of the family every night. And there is a protocol that we have that the child is given some time to finish the meal, and if they don't, they have to supplement it with a nutritional supplement. And if that, and at the same time, by the way, they are medically monitored every week initially, and then later on it goes to every 2 weeks. If at any time their vital signs become unstable, they get hospitalized. So most of the treatment is done as an outpatient, but sometimes they need to be hospitalized. And you may know that we have a fairly large inpatient eating disorders program here. We have a 15-bed unit, and we attract patients from many of the Western states.
Now, inherent in that treatment, it seems, is that prior to or during the development of this eating disorder, that that's not happening, that the family is not having this sort of sit-down control of eating, correct?
That's right.
You're finding dysfunction within the eating
patterns? I'm not sure
patterns?
It's dysfunction.
What
you yourself said it's just our American way of life, right? People are busy. The kids get up in the morning, they go to school, they come back, they go to soccer, they go to gymnastics, they go to dance lessons, then they come back and they're studying for their SAT tests or they're doing AP courses. We overburden our kids. And so kids are pressurized, and an eating disorder is one of their solutions to the problem that they perceive. I think sometimes we just have to take a step back and see what is healthy. Again, focusing on healthy behaviors, healthy lifestyle. That's not necessarily a healthy lifestyle. And different people cope in different ways. Some adults may cope with substance abuse or other issues, but many adolescents find this as a way of coping with the issues that are confronted, that confront them and they're trying to address.
What is the conversation that you hope that parents have with their children about food?
Food should be enjoyable. Mealtime should be enjoyable. Food is not fat, and fat included in your meal doesn't translate to fat on your buttocks or your thighs. We've distorted how we interpret food. I think we can learn a lot from France and other places where people really seem to enjoy their food in moderate portion sizes and enjoy a conversation around mealtimes. Somehow here in our country, portion sizes are larger, food is consumed rapidly, it's not enjoyed. The quality of the food is often processed and sold in bulk. And so I think there's a lot that we can reflect on our relationship with food.
So what are the guidelines urging pediatricians about how to discuss, talk with an adolescent who has weight problems?
Well, there are actually 5 guidelines. The first one is to discourage dieting for the reasons I've already expressed. The other is to avoid weight talk. And this is really a message primarily for the parents.
And describe weight talk.
Weight talk is the comments about weight, either about yourself or about someone else.
Oh, that person's too fat. Or
exactly.
Oh, that person's too thin. Or they should lose weight.
Exactly. Because that doesn't do anything for weight loss or promote a healthy body image. The other is not to use body dissatisfaction as a motivator to lose weight, because that also doesn't work. And then the 2 things to promote are family meals, and then also to promote the health, focus less on weight, but on healthy eating and a healthy lifestyle. But the final thing that the pediatrician can do is really monitor the weight loss and watch out for the behaviors that are red flags. For example, the cutting out of meals, or fasting for a couple of days, or the use of diet pills or laxatives. So the pediatrician can ask about that. And in addition to just examining or measuring weight, we should also measure vital signs as well. Ask about other things. For example, a young girl who loses her periods. That's a red flag that something is going on. This is not just healthy weight loss. Something is off. And so intervene early. Don't wait until that individual has lost 100 pounds and ends up in a medical unit. Try and intervene a little earlier.
What are you all hoping that the outcome will be of these new guidelines?
I think the outcome would be a greater awareness of how to approach this issue of both obesity and eating disorders. And the language can be the same because the behaviors that need to be addressed are the same. I think that's the most important thing. Previously, you had the obesity researchers, the eating disorders researchers, and there were two silos with no communication between the two. And what this report has done, it's amalgamated the evidence base to support an integrated approach to both disorders.
Neville Golden, thank you for joining me in Wonder One.
Thank you for having me.
The preceding program is copyrighted by the Board of Trustees of Stanford University. One to One is produced by the School of Medicine's Office of Communication and Public Affairs. For more information, please visit us at mednews.stanford.edu.